One-on-one instruction is one thing. One instructor and more than one student is a whole nother deal. Today on the Back Porch Education Podcast, Steve and I discuss how many students ought to be taught. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon. Give me a minute. I don't have a Frost poem at the ready. Okay? So it's gonna, but I'm thinking by the end of the episode, Steve, something will strike me.
It'll take me a minute to get off the floor. So no poem. Now I don't know what to do. This is confusing to me.
Oh, this is scary. How do we begin? Oh, let's...
Normally segue so easily from poem to... No, we want to jump in and discuss a common problem. And we kind of have two audiences to some extent with this podcast. Those who are educating at home and those who are more... the traditional classroom teacher, but this is a subject for both of them.
Yep.
In many regards. I have spent most of my career teaching in schools that sort of have to keep the doors open by taking a very wide range of students as to abilities, backgrounds, proclivities, and put a good number of them into one room.
Yep.
And assign a subject to the teacher and say good luck.
Yeah, yeah.
And so a lot of my career has been trying to figure out how to not leave anyone behind and not bore anyone that could be way out ahead.
Mm.
So there is that discussion, I think, in this topic.
Yeah.
And then there's sort of the home education. You know, it's fewer students, perhaps, so to speak. You might only have three or four or five children that you're trying to teach, but the age problem, right?
Yep.
Now you've got
maturity, age.
I got a kindergartner and a third grader and an eighth grader. What do you?
Pray.
Where do you aim?
You pray.
And of course, kindergarten, third, and eighth. I purposely chose three of the more difficult.
Yeah.
years.
Man.
If you
right.
can teach third grade, you can teach anything. Let me throw it to you first, Jason. What's a principle that would stand out here to get us started when it comes to this kind of a situation?
Yeah. So I think when it comes to let me start here. Don't beat me up about this. Because I'm a little embarrassed that I know it, but the fancy educationese word for this is differentiated instruction.
Correct.
Right. And, oh, you know it too.
Oh, I hear a lot about it.
Okay. So in this world, right, of how we're... I bring up the term only because I do think that it is... an interesting and particular way of thinking about this situation, right? And maybe by the end of the podcast, we can come up with other terms that we think are get at the problem a different way or get at the situation a different way, label it something else. Because I think when you label it differentiated instruction, then you're already off on the wrong foot.
Oh, well, we'll explain that.
Okay, so when you say that each of my students needs... I don't want to paint them into a box, the sort of other side, but without trying to be uncharitable, if you say each of my students or groups of my students require different things... You're already really hard pressed to deliver that because you're only one person. Additionally, I would disagree. I don't think that different students, yes, they are different humans, But I don't think that they do need something or require something or would benefit from something different. I think without getting cookie cutter, we can insist that the best education for one is the best education for all. We can insist that there is a set of ideas or an idea that is worth contemplating together. Different modes, different people getting at the same thing, not at different things.
Yeah, I think the differentiation is usually speaking about ability, and the fact that, in any given classroom setting, a graded setting where they're all, let's say, 10th graders,
right?
There's kind of that baseline: a 10th grader should be able to do X,
right?
What do you do about those that, for various reasons, can't get up to X?
Right. Or are at 3X.
Right, or at Z, at a higher level.
Yeah.
Where do I, if they're above that baseline, do I just leave them be? Leaving a student be is always a nervous thing.
Oh, absolutely.
And leaving anyone behind, just I can't really help you and keep everybody else occupied. And so it is a problem.
Yeah.
I agree that if you alleviate the problem by basically creating, I'm going to say, three classrooms in one.
Yeah, right.
That isn't a solution, because the one teacher has now got to try and teach in three levels at once.
Right.
Obviously, and many why did you
cut
schools.
It, yeah, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but why did you cut it into three instead of four classrooms, or three instead of two, or three instead of 20 if there are 20 kids in
the
classroom?
Right, right, right.
Like, and you've only done that because it can
there's the
help.
Middle,
right,
and those lagging behind that, and those ahead of it,
right,
and even you're right. If there's 20 kids in the class, it's not that you have just three performance levels. You have a continuum of performance levels.
Absolutely.
With a broad spectrum of reasons behind why they're performing the way they're performing.
Yes.
It is not, it can never be just about ability.
Correct.
I've had very capable students fail my classes over a motivational issue.
Yeah.
Or over a season of life issue.
Yeah, sure, of course.
I can think of one young man that, went through the death of a grandfather. And there for a good semester and a half, he wasn't his normal self.
Mm.
He was in the midst of grief. He was dealing with something that life had thrown at him. And for a little while, his normal, high-performing self wasn't there.
Yeah.
And nobody sort of knew what to do, because this is a kid, straight-A student, that's suddenly failing.
Yeah.
What do you... So right. That requires
something.
And he
doesn't need a talking to.
Right.
Like, he's not going to benefit from the carrot or the whip.
Right. Well, the typical motivation for him was high grades, and at that point it had disappeared from his mind. He had other things occupying
right.
it.
Right.
But he was well aware.
Yeah.
That, I mean, if you sat him down for a talking to, he'd give you most of your points.
Yes.
You know, I know.
Right.
I know. But I would... I guess right out the bat, I don't think there's a formula to kick in here.
Yeah.
I think that the principals have to include a good, thoroughgoing knowledge and relationship with your students.
Absolutely.
Made much easier and, I would say, even more valuable if it's in a home education setting. These are your children. I would warn the home educator against trying to somehow... We've talked about this before, but formalize the home setting into a school setting.
Right.
The reason for different levels of performance is known to you. It's age.
Right.
Like, my 5-year-old and my 13-year-old are just better not be.
Right.
At this. Well, if the 5-year-old's up there with the 13-year-old, then...
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe we don't... It's not such a problem.
But I do think one of the first principles is a good, earnest... desire to know that you know this student,
right,
rather than just making assumptions.
Right.
But that doesn't really I would guess most listeners are going, well, duh.
Sure.
Where do you move beyond that? And it's almost, I think, at this point where we need to deal with one scenario or the other come back to the other. Because they're not going to be solved in the same ways.
Right.
So you kind of dealt with the in-class multiple levels of performance within an age group, all of which obviously aren't, even though they might all be 15-year-olds, not every 15-year-old is at the same level of maturity. So, again, you're going to have to know them and understand, well, the reason for this student lagging behind is less about their ability to learn the material, more about personal management skills or motivation, or the fact that they're working every night for their dad on the farm. It's still going to be an almost case by case setting.
Yeah, it's got to be. I think how are you going to get around that? You know, I guess I just,
well, a good teacher.
Yeah.
Let's just stick with writing, which you and I both teach.
Okay, sure.
Is not going to be as concerned. I mean, you have your minimum standards, whatever those might be.
Right.
And someone not coming up to that, we would typically deal with outside the class with additional help.
Right.
Right. I wouldn't slow the whole class down to keep pace with Johnny, who's just not, he needs extra help. He doesn't need to be the pace of the whole class.
Right.
And then conversations can be had about whether or not he's properly placed.
Right.
But I would start by additional time with him outside of class, trying to get him to that minimum.
Right. And additional work for him. Right?
Sure, absolutely.
Hopefully. I mean, I guess it depends on the grade, but the age, the maturity of the student. But I would think that initially it's going to be, if you think about Adler's fact, skills, ideas, well, what are you lacking? Are you lacking facts? Here, kid, read the book. If you're lacking skills, then here's training in the skills. Practice these skills.
Right.
And if you're lacking contemplation of the ideas or a grasp of the ideas, Let's talk.
That's the exciting thing
right,
to me.
Yeah, exactly.
The glue is the ideas.
Right.
Right. And this, I see this all the time with my seminar.
You mean the glue in the writing or the glue in the conversation?
In forming a unified class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Good.
So one writes at this level and another at a much lower level. Obviously, the better writer might be able to make some peer review comments to help.
Of course,
the one struggling, but when you with the facts, with the knowledge, one just acquires them more easily than another, and again there can be a back and forth, a quizzing, a study group, or whatever you want to call it, that provides help for everyone, but the ideas, right?
Yes.
The discussion, the thought,
right?
Often, someone who maybe is behind in the other two areas leads in the ability to ask questions, the ability to be curious, the ability to look at it from a different angle.
Exactly.
I think almost immediately of students who have a diagnosed learning disability, like in specific dyslexia, where their brain is just wired in a different way. So them trying to, in particular, read in the normal way, the way everybody else is wired to read is very difficult. Mm-hmm. But the amazing thing about somebody like that is that their brain is wired in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely, right.
So when you get into the discussion, they're the one that comes in from that really wild 313 degree strange angle and flies in and goes, ga-boom, and the quote-unquote normal thinkers, the average thing, the rest are all huddled over here looking at it from this angle.
Right.
And somebody sails in from another direction, and they're all like, whoa, I never thought of that before.
Right.
And that diversity is needed.
Absolutely.
In a classroom. You used cookie cutter earlier.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing more horrific than the notion, you know, the our theme song is working off of, you know, Pink Floyd's notion of if you've seen the video, little kids coming off the assembly line, another brick in the wall.
Exactly.
It's not, that's not exciting to any educator.
No, I agree. I think conversation of ideas is radically equal when it is done right. And what does it mean for it to do right or for it to be done right? Maybe that's a conversation for another time. But I would say that it starts with charity, right? With being charitable to others and being genuinely interested. And the list goes on. But anyway, when that happens, when that culture is cultivated, you know, man, it is, I agree that you never know where truth is going to find its way in. Right.
Well, and the difference among the conversants is what provides something for everyone. So you've got this brilliant, always thinking deep, always pushing further, that quote-unquote straight A.
Yeah.
The teacher's pet, so to
speak.
Sure,
yeah.
Right? And you'd think that sitting in a good conversation would be boring for them because of all of these dolts that are sitting here, you know? And yet, if done, as you said, if done properly, their position is from above, right? And sure. So as they try and think through the idea,
yeah,
that if it's done properly and it's the big ideas,
right,
can never be mastered.
Yeah,
can never be wrestled to the ground. And there, we know everything there is to know about justice or
nobility.
Love,
right?
Love is done. We've finally figured it out, right? Regardless of their ability, they're still under the idea.
Yes,
the idea is bigger than they are.
That's right.
So they're still trying. There's things they're trying to figure out, and these dolts, which I don't want to call them that, but these ones below the teacher's pet, are benefited from hearing whatever that person's saying, but the one up above benefits from revisiting in a different way,
right?
The lesser ruminations,
right,
of somebody who's still, and I see this because I've taught my seminar class a number of times now. I know these works better than these kids that are going through it the first time.
Sure.
But my hardest struggle in that class is shutting my mouth. Because Plato and Pieper and Augustine and Camus and all these dudes, de Tocqueville, are fascinating to me.
Yes.
And if I'm not careful, I forget that it's for the students.
Yep.
Because it once again becomes for me.
Sure, right. It becomes a lecture not out of not out of a necessity or not out of a desire to cover the material, but just because it's Mr. Elliot standing up there and he's just amped.
Well, I don't want you to give a false impression of my class.
Yeah, sure.
It's Mr. Elliot seated with his students.
There you go, yeah, good.
Being a student.
Right.
And I don't, it might turn into a monologue instead of a dialogue, but I don't know that it turns into a lecture.
Yeah, good.
I can usually sense when I'm slipping into...
Yeah.
And there is some of that for them to understand definitions or...
context.
Maybe some historical context. We try and keep these great texts, not, I won't say out of context, but I don't get caught up in studying them historically.
Right.
They are a text in and of themselves. They are ideas that are timeless.
Yeah.
So I don't see the need to put them back into their time.
Right.
But it's Eliot thinking new thoughts.
Right.
And wanting to express them.
Yep.
Because I love conversation.
Yep.
And then remembering, but this is these. But guys
if other people want to love it too, yeah, then I need to just can it. Right.
I have this teacher mantle on that I get the time if I want it.
Yeah, man. So just sort of in line with that, my second or third year of teaching, I taught the Euthyphro Dilemma out of Plato's Euthyphro, which is Socrates and his dialogue with Euthyphro. Anyway, the in particular dilemma is not that important, but that moment, because we talked about it for a long time with a seventh graders, and you want to talk about overestimating your students. I think I did, right? In saying, go nuts. It's the Euthyphro dilemma, right? Like, what are the moral groundings of goodness? It was, for me, so amazing because I remember standing and sort of, I mean, it's seventh grader, so I'm doing some sort of traffic cop, come on, you come on. Okay, now you stop. Now you go, now you go. And we're having this conversation and this dilemma, this debate, which I had been over in my philosophy courses many a times, I had been over with my buds many a times, one of the students said something and, I stood at the board sort of dumbstruck, like, huh. And so the kids, they kind of do the 3 to 5 second, this is okay. And then they kind of start to get nervous, like, do we need to call the EMT or something? And they say, Mr. Dolan, what's going on? And I said, no, it's okay. I think I'm changing my mind, right? I think I'm actually working through this and genuinely swapping. Mm-hmm. That may be scary, I don't know, to other teachers. Maybe I just didn't know enough to be scared then, that I would look bad for not knowing the answer or something like that. But
at the heart of that is that there isn't necessarily a settled answer.
Exactly. It's still a dilemma.
It is.
Right, exactly. So
it's a human dilemma, I being a human.
Right, I fit squarely into it. It
seems like it applies.
Right. So, yeah, that's, I don't know, perhaps we've strayed a bit, but that moment in particular was a good one. And I guess for me it shows, or it highlights the extreme between, I had students in that class who really didn't give too much of a care. And I had others who were both tremendously able and highly motivated. And I, being a grown man, was far more equipped than any of them. And yet, in that moment, we were all partaking.
Yeah, and you have to say something too. I don't want to sell the whole ship down the road. I'm not the modes of learning that some are auditory and some are graphical and so on and so forth. But I do think that if you have a wide range of students in a classroom, having a wide range of activities.
Mm-hmm.
Not falling into a rut in your classroom is useful. I have in literature, I have students that love it when it's more formal debate, highly rational.
Mm-hmm.
I want to yell at people. And I'm at that point just a referee.
Sure.
I have other kids that abhor that, but if I say, hey, we've been reading about the Red Cross Knight and the Fairy Queen and the House of Pride.
Mm-hmm.
Draw me a floor plan of the House of Pride or represent that for me graphically.
Wow.
Those same ones that love the formal debate now are looking pretty sheepish. Well, I can't really draw.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. Yeah. It's all right. We can't all do everything.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's another kid sitting there that hated the formal debate, now rubbing his hands like, all right.
That's great.
I can do this. I think the same is to be said at times for individual work versus the group work.
Mm-hmm.
I think that many teachers have certain modes that they're most comfortable with.
Absolutely.
Their class reflects that.
Absolutely.
And so at times, they're sort of setting themselves up to really appeal to a certain group of students,
mm-hmm.
and constantly sort of have to motivate or even fight with another group of students.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you do yourself a favor if rather than teaching to what you think is your strength or what you would like,
yep.
trying to be well-rounded and give opportunities. Group work is great if it, rather than pairing all of the high-powered ones together,
right,
and then the struggling ones all together,
yep.
a good mixture,
right,
and then proper supervision, where at least what I often see is they understand the differences in the room between themselves if they're
right.
familiar with
right, one right,
and so the stronger student helps along the weaker, and it's much more ennobling for him to experience that
yep.
than he's got to go up to the teacher and get that extra help now while yep. the rest of us do our thing.
Right.
So, but I wouldn't recommend, you know, dividing them up physically and having a group that everybody knows doesn't have as much expected of them.
Yeah. Right.
And another group that's constantly feeling as though, why do we have to do so much more than anybody else?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And some schools like that, you know, we play the weighted game where we have honors classes
yep.
and we have college prep, and now we've kind of got a, I don't know what you'd call it, normal?
Yeah. Okay.
You can't call it
right
underachieving right. or something like that. But we have, they're trying to put more like kids in a class together, especially in something as differentiating as, say, math
yeah.
or English. But I don't know that I'm pleased with that. I enjoy the like, I get 18 in a class right now that are strung out all over the ability
mm-hmm.
spectrum,
mm-hmm.
and they are better.
Yes.
Then I've got a class of 8 that are almost identical in ability.
Right.
We can move faster.
Sure.
If that's your goal.
Yeah.
But the other class is going to take a lot longer to get through things.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to get through it all in a lot more interesting fashion.
Right, exactly.
And I think yeah. everybody's going to enjoy it more than this highly competitive, ooh, you got an 88, well, I got a 99
yeah,
kind
yeah,
of
yeah.
strange stuff that sometimes goes on.
So have you read, I read a book, dude, it's been like a while ago now, probably 6 or 7 years ago, that is called A Mathematician's Lament.
No.
Okay. So it's a book by a guy named Paul Lockhart, and I don't remember a ton about it, but I do remember enjoying the book quite a bit, and I do remember one of the things that he says in there, in his book. He says, somebody says, well, wait a minute, like if you broke up the graded nature of math, you're in the normal class, you're in the gifted class, you're
yeah,
in the AP class or whatever,
right.
if you broke that up, then you wouldn't be able to teach math the same way or something like that. And Lockhart says, well, we haven't taught math in years, right? That essentially that now what we have done, oh gosh, I just don't remember that he said this, but the sense that I got from reading that book is that essentially I remember him saying is, that we have eviscerated math of the ideas.
Mm-hmm, right.
And we have made it entirely a class of skills.
Function.
Yes, functions, exactly. And when you then, when it's just a skills game, then all you do is divide the students by skills and boom, you're off to the races.
Right.
That's bad.
Yeah, I agree.
And
yeah.
And you and I don't like that when it comes to English. If it just comes about, comes to be about sentence formation and subject-verb agreement and correct paragraphs, you know, and good introductions, then it just becomes, it's a little different, but it's still a skills game. And I don't want to teach that class.
Well, the only reason to teach the skills is to get past that to the stuff.
Right, exactly.
Right, and exactly. If you've made that the end game, he's absolutely right. You haven't taught all of math.
Right.
Skills are a part of it.
Right.
But, you know, we get past our times tables to get to the really interesting stuff.
Exactly.
And many students check out of math about the time it starts to get interesting.
I completely agree.
Because they have been taught wrong.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
I subbed for ninth grade math a couple weeks, or like last week.
They let you?
They did, yeah.
Wow.
Well, then it wasn't as a let as much as a desperately needed. And so they said, you know, the math teacher said, so can you teach my ninth grade math? And I said, I will, but on one condition. She's like, okay. So I said, I don't want to use your stuff. I want to just let me, it's the last day before fall break, just let me go in and do what I want to do, right? And it was a lot of fun, you know, to talk not about equations. Like, what do you do when there's not an equation? When you have a problem, but you have no idea what equation you're supposed to use to find the solution. Well, you got to build an equation. Mm. How do you do that? That's math, right? Like, now, come on, man. Yeah. Like, that's fun stuff.
Start with Euclid. Right? His first sentence, a point is that which has no parts.
There you go. A point is that which has no parts. Yeah.
And you start there.
Yeah.
And you just keep thinking.
Right.
And before long, you're doing stuff in geometry you'd never dreamt of in a quote-unquote typical class.
Yeah.
It is an interesting thing to look through. Well, let's shift gears before we end.
Yeah.
And take a quick shot at those who are not facing several kids of the same age with different skills.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got a class, I've got a home.
Yeah.
That has several different ages. What do you do?
Right. Okay, so straight off the bat, I would say you're going to have them again next year, probably. The plan is to have them again.
Yeah.
So,
it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Exactly, so don't fret. Second, I think this applies actually to both. Prioritize. Like, whatever... Right, what do I do? Well, do the most important things. What's most important to you? What's most important in your child's education? Do those things. And if it takes your child, if you're like, look, I've got 3 hours to devote each day to my three kids' education, and I can't figure out a way to do it other than to teach them one-on-one, okay.
I'm not going to say okay to that.
Well, even still, I'm like, let's start here, though. Let's start here. Take 1 hour for each child. Give them one-on-one instruction of the most important things. And then the other 2 hours, when those other two kids are sitting there, tell them to do something. And they'll do it poorly at first. But the reason I'm okay with granting it is because I have a sneaking suspicion that when... that eighth grader and that kindergartner start talking while you're teaching the third grader, somebody before too long is going to come around the corner and be like, now wait a minute, what about... And then you're back
to where you want to be. Well, no, I see your point. So you're really pushing something that's the word that I would use, which is integrated instruction.
Yeah, okay.
I would really be nervous about somebody with three kids that they feel... each need 2 to 3 hours a day. And so now you're talking 6 to 9 hours.
for mom or dad or both.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't need to do that.
No, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Our conversation earlier set the table for a discussion of ideas.
Yes. Right.
So skills aren't going to take a great deal of instruction time. It needs alone time within your feedback.
Yes.
Writing, working on math problems, etc.
Right.
Exactly. So I'm going to get too scatterbrained here. Let's start with the core that you're basically teaching two languages to your children. Three, if you want to teach a foreign language.
Okay.
But at the heart of it, you've got words and
letters,
you've got numbers.
And numbers, yeah, good.
So teaching numbers within the context of nature, by that I mean using physical science, chemistry, biology, etc., as grist for the mathematical mill.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm teaching you about the world of number by teaching you about discrete things in nature.
Yes.
Has already combined what would have been several subjects in school into a probably more arresting and interesting and engaging discussion in the home that doesn't require that they spend 45 minutes on this and then switch to another teacher. You've got one teacher, and at times, this is the other aspect, whether it's with the word, which I would say literature, history, writing, all of that can be incorporated. And please, we can do a whole nother podcast on this, but please avoid the nonsense of modern English where I've got to have vocabulary lists and spelling lists and all this crap.
Right.
Read.
Yes.
Read well. Learn to look it up if you don't know it.
Right.
Learn phonetically. And all of that takes care of itself in the context of really good books that make them have to learn a larger vocabulary.
That's right.
And not by memorizing word lists.
Right.
So I can get rid of a lot of nonsense, and I can combine subjects, if you will, and get it down to where really, now I'm just asking, well, what about the kindergartner, third grader, eighth grader? Okay, again, with skills, that's individuated.
Yeah.
And so kindergartner's over here working on handwriting, let's say, letter formation. Third grader's over here learning how to write a paragraph. Eighth grader's writing paragraphs.
Right.
Hopefully about what they're studying, not just some, let's use the word random here, thing that you came up with to keep them busy.
Right.
But as they write or copy down their letters or whatnot, they're doing it in a way that enhances the history or the literature or even the science that they've been studying.
Yeah.
But keep in mind that the skills are going to be done individually. The factual material, if you focus on teaching your children to read well early,
yes,
then they can acquire a lot of that information through reading,
right,
which is of itself an individual.
Yes.
Although I highly admire the family that reads together.
Right.
And there's an activity that all three can do at the same time.
That's right.
You pick it, right? White Fang is going to mesmerize the kindergartner, the third grader, and the eighth grader.
That's right.
At a different level.
Yep.
But again, where we arrived in solving one problem solves another. This notion of the seminar, the discussion, the conversation. If kindergartner, third grader, and eighth grader have a relationship with mom or dad that allows for a round table discussion, and if you've chosen to make, let's say, a theme, if your kids are spread out enough, it doesn't hurt anyone to match your literature and history up with a given chronology. You know, we're doing medieval this year, guys. Sharpen your swords or whatever.
Right, right.
Then they can be studying different aspects of that theme, but reading works with you. You know, it's King Arthur this year.
Right.
And I don't know if I'm making as much sense as I have in my head.
No, I think
but my
you are.
Point is, bring it together. Find ways to integrate. Find ways for all of your children to study similar things at the same time with you, mm-hmm. instead of this notion that I've got to have it all divided up.
Okay, good. When you said I can combine subjects, I almost stopped you and busted you right there. but I didn't. I'm glad I didn't, because you eventually got back around to it. What I wanted to say when you said that was, no, we're not combining subjects, but we're removing false divisions.
Yep.
Right? And so, for the person who says, oh, what, you're removing all divisions? I didn't say all of the divisions. You made a division right at the outset. You said words, numbers.
Yeah.
Like, and the divisions continue. Medieval, not medieval. Okay, right. Fine. That's a division. Right, that's enough, right? But just that we're going to remove the false divisions because those are things that keep us and our students out of the ideas.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And instead, let's make it as easy as we can to gain access to those things.
Well, we know that there's a podcast coming up on analysis and synthesis.
Oh, boy.
On things apart, dividing, right. Fragmenting knowledge,
right.
And bringing it back together.
Yep.
And that will help with this. But,
yes.
But this notion of universals, this notion of unified truth needs to work its way into the heart of a home educator with excitement that I can actually teach this without the bells going off and sending them down the hall to another expert in a given field. As useful as that might be in that context, I'm not in that context.
Right.
So let's revel in what I get to do that made me make this choice.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than trying to regret my way back into, well, I'm going to offer a school education to my child at home.
Right.
Why are you doing that?
Yeah, exactly. I agree. All right. Well, I think that's a good place to end and, as always, begin. So, Steve, I appreciate your time.
Yeah.